rather than a strict sort of interrogation. Although, I do have this little... Well, never mind. Anyway, it is August 19th. This is Paul Rodell again, IVS Oral History Project. And today I'm in Overbrook, Kansas, with Larry Woodson. And Larry and I have talked some late in the afternoon, and then Larry's wife Dee came, and we had dinner, and now we're sitting around again, this time with the tape recorder on. Larry was in Laos 1964 through 71, so a very long period of time. 2 years as a volunteer in the royal capital of Luang Prabang, and then for almost, well, we'll maybe get the dates down in terms of, you know, what months, but going on towards 3 years as Associate Chief of Party for Education in the field, and then off to Dundalk, where all those other people were. Not Associate Chief of Party, that was another title, wasn't it?
They called it Deputy Chief of Party, I think, for the education.
Okay, yeah.
Slight change.
Slight change, but basically doing pretty much the same work, but you didn't have to travel all over maybe as much. So, but you look like you're looking toward the sheet here.
No problem.
I'm just putting that out of the way because we don't really need that, at least at this point. Because I did, when reading through your sheet, just write down a couple extra questions, and we can get to those later because we probably will cover all the stuff anyway, just naturally. But anyway, starting out, oh, those are your notes?
Yeah, those are my outline notes. All the things I went back and tried to just kind of catch
things
that might be of interest. Or
good. Not many people.
It starts off of, if you made a recruitment by one of the IVSers, Larry Loggins, who was IVS Vietnam, but came back to K-State and was recruiting.
Okay.
A little bit of that.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Starting off, if you may, as far as volunteer experience.
Right. Well, I'll take it a little bit further back.
Okay.
Like to birth.
Oh, that's a long way.
Yeah. Because we've been asking people where and when they were born and how they were brought up and what their parents were like. The object here is to get some, you know, idea of the people, you know, who are we dealing with here? And also coming up in there would be the influences on your young life that got you to the point where when you met a guy like Larry, he would have an impact, you know, on you, whereas he might not have an impact on other people.
Sure.
So now I can just shut up and turn it over to you.
Okay. Well, in my particular situation, I was born in Kingman, Kansas, which is about south central part of the state. And that was back in January of 1941. I attended a small two-room rural school, and I actually ended up starting, I think, when I was five, because there's only going to be three other kids in that particular grade, and so my parents wanted me to go ahead and start early. So off we went to this two-room school, and there was four of us in grade one, and so I went ahead and went to that particular grade school for 6 years before transferring into Kingman, which was, of course, a county seat, and probably a population of about 4,000. I finished junior high there and on through high school there. And then following high school, went to Kansas State University and went in ag education. And that's what I ended up graduating in.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to, if you may, rural Kingman, Kansas, certainly had neighbors a quarter mile away, had relatives about half mile away. Grew up with, of course, livestock. My dad was a dairy farmer in the early years, and so we milked cattle, which meant you had to get up early in the morning and milk, and you had to be home and milk in the evening, and you did that 365 days a year. So being a rural Kansas farm boy, I had the same probably 4-H experiences a lot of other rural youth. I guess I started out with a dairy calf, and showed it at the local county fair. And, of course, you had your project books and all the things associated with 4-H where you kept track of what you fed it and kept track of all your expenses and did that sort of thing. And then going through and having the other 4-H experience as far as the club days, we had a square dance group that we danced in festivals. Went through, of course, all of the different offices within 4-H and went on. And I guess I stayed with 4-H as long as you can. And was fortunate enough to go ahead and become a Who's Who award winner in 4-H there. And in conjunction with 4-H, I got a couple of free trips to Chicago and Kansas City to 4-H activities there. I guess the farm experiences were of course, they were working experiences. It seemed like at a fairly young age you had either some livestock or something you had to take care of, helping with yard work, but always some responsibilities down on the farm. It wasn't though you had a lot of time for other things.
That's building character.
And in about 1950, I know things were a little tough on the farm because earlier my dad had an airplane. I could hardly wait for it to get old enough that I might be able to fly the airplane, but it got sold during the hard times on the farm, and my dad went to work at Boeing and helped build B-52 aircraft. And during that period of time, it'd be about time I was a junior and senior in high school, so that meant I had to get up and milk the cows while he was working in the aircraft factory. And it worked out where I could go out for athletics in high school, and so I did certainly play high school football and tennis and basketball, and I think I lettered 3 years in tennis. Certainly a couple of years in basketball, I believe, and a couple in football, but certainly active in athletics. And of course, you get into high school, you got into FFA activities, Future Farming of America, and so certainly had an office there, and eventually also following up on the 4-H, but I became a state farmer and got to go to 4-H judging contest and FFA judging contest, and that got you acquainted with a lot of the other agriculture people and other farm kids across Kansas, and of course those were always fun times, and going to the county fair and the state fair. But anyway, those were just a lot of the kind of experiences I had growing up, so it was farm, certainly your 4-H and FFA type club activities. I was active in, reasonably active in Sunday school. Had several guys that I played basketball with that we always, of course, made sure we First Christian Church.
Okay.
And
you said something else too. There's, you were a state farmer,
right?
What is that? What does that mean?
Well, state farmer degree is that in any. Of course, we used to have a lot more BOAG chapters than what we do today. But you could go in and take 4 years of BOAG. Your freshman year was just basically, well, I guess all 4 years really learning about agriculture.
This is in high school.
Yes.
Yeah.
A full curriculum. Your first year, they called it a green hand, and you went through, and again, you learned. You had different crops classes, and,
mm-hmm.
Welding classes. You made projects out in the shop. I remember making I overhauled a manure spreader 1 year. I built a hay feeder another year. But there was projects like that you had to build, so you developed skills and everything from using a forge to welding to cutting wood, building projects with wood. So it was a little bit different. It's more of a farm-oriented course as comparison with industrial arts, which would be more cabinetry or furniture. So
mm-hmm.
it's more, I call it raw construction versus fine construction, if you may.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, as you went through the FFA curriculum, by certainly those who either because of their farming, or because of their livestock operations, or because of the projects they had on the farm, they could be nominated by the teacher for, I think they had a regional contest, but certainly a state contest, and then only about 100 of the top FFA students were selected into the state farmer degree.
Uh-huh.
So it was, I think certainly everybody still respects it. As pretty prestigious
mm-hmm.
deal to be one of 200 farm kids in Kansas recognized as a state farmer degree.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, for those who even had bigger projects and were more successful, they were still an American farmer degree, and that's, of course, even bigger. I think there's only about 4 to 6 from the whole state of Kansas that went on to become American farmers, and so it narrows it down pretty fast.
Okay, because, so, you know, even though I grew up in Illinois, and it was in a rural area, I didn't hear about those, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. They must have this similar kind of program.
I'm sure they do. Yeah. It's a national... Certain FFA is a national organization, and vocational agriculture, I think, is just hot in a lot of states.
All of them, and not in all school districts. But
so I guess if I went back to just kind of generally characterize it, it's one of, you know, certainly farm, livestock, responsibility, and then blending that in with athletics and school activities and club activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, whatever influence then certainly the church would have on that. So that kind of would balance the kind of the background, if you may, up through high school.
Yeah, and the way I see it, I'll throw this out and see what you think. The responsibility of the farm certainly built the character and the discipline and got you interested in the field. And so that made the 4-H Club natural, but it was also became a social effort too,
mm-hmm.
and in the sense of forming you and working with other people and that sort of thing. So, but were you mostly an extrovert or an introvert?
I probably tended to be a little bit more on the introvert. I don't think I was very much, I mean, not really outgoing. Yeah, I had friends and, but to say that I was gung-ho in terms of leadership, to say I was gung-ho in terms of public speaking, or to say that I was really out lobbying or campaigning for offices, no.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of somewhere about 2 levels back of that, somewhere back in there. I mean, I wasn't just sit on the bench, not get involved, and I don't know whether my parents had to really push me that hard, but certainly I was not one that was going to be the leader and the biggest, the best, the fastest, or whatever else. I wasn't that level.
Mm-hmm.
However you characterize that.
However you characterize that, yeah, I know. But still, you know, you got to be ACOP. I mean,
mm-hmm.
so somebody recognized that you were already had developed some leadership skills
mm-hmm.
and some social skills. Because, I mean, that's a lot of what, you know, associate chief of party would have to have. I mean, they wouldn't look at somebody who was totally withdrawn and asocial, you know. So I was just, it just occurred to me while you were talking about all of these things that, my gosh, there's a lot of stuff there. You know, you got to work with the team for basketball and all this. You got to work with other people for 4-H projects, even if you're doing your own thing.
I would say probably it was more 4-H and FFA, the combination of those two.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, your sports are certainly part of the teamwork environment, and yeah, you play
not
a
as
role,
much for tennis, but certainly for basketball.
But in terms of you think of both 4-H and FFA, both of them tended to have offices and a little bit more of a leadership opportunity. And then you had some public speaking and projects you had to give.
Yeah,
I remember early on we had a team demonstration, and we was showing how you could take a coffee can and a couple pieces of plywood and make a reel to roll up electric cord. And our particular demonstration was chosen to be put on the local TV station.
Uh-huh.
So here we are, probably sophomore in high school, and that's probably not so unique today, but it was then because TV was still fairly
was still
new
unique itself. You know?
I remember the two of us going over to the TV station I think I was probably a little bit more tongue-tied than probably what I am today, but it was an interesting experience to be on TV then and give a demonstration back in those days.
Yeah.
And that was
that was really unique. Yeah. That.
But some of the other experiences of, you know, going to Chicago, going up on your own when you're about a junior in high school, or even going to Kansas City when you're a freshman, sophomore in high school, that was
mm-hmm.
going to the big city and going to the big national FFA convention, and here was, whatever they get up there now, 25,000 FFA boys
right.
and girls from all across the United States attending, and
uh-huh.
and that was impressive to see all those blue jackets and listen to some of those people, because I can assure you they were some extremely polished speakers. that could get on the stage and you would swear they were running for president or something. Because, I mean, they were extremely good at that age. And it was, you know, it's something to go and watch other youth, and I'm sure it had some influence on my own life as well as others to watch young kids from across the United States that are that dynamic and, mm-hmm. and have that just that much more leadership capability to stand up for in front of 10,000 people and motivate them and also tell about some, you know, extremely well-managed projects.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always some amazing kids. I look at some of my own students and the ones who are really good, I say, geez, what was I like when I was their age? Ooh. I wasn't anywhere near that good, you know.
I think as much trouble as other people. I think a lot of mine, fortunately, were not situations that hurt other people, but you know, we did all those things I suppose other people did. We tipped over outhouses during
Halloween.
Halloween.
Yep.
And we went, did a lot of hunting, night hunting with spotlights, which would be illegal today.
Ooh.
But we had so many jackrabbits back in those days. That's back in the days.
Oh, you were using
thousands and thousands of jackrabbits around, and so nobody was too concerned if you went out and shot them at night because they were eating up the crops, and you had big rabbit drives even then. But I can remember certainly we drove cars around and crashed snowdrifts, and we went rabbit hunting, and we did a lot of horseback riding at nights, and we roped calves in the middle of a pasture at nights that our parents didn't always out running all the fat off the cows, if you may. And my wife likes to tell the story about how I even burnt down my grandfather's barn. So I got involved in extracurricular activities. I even went when I was in Kansas City. I bought some itching powder up there, and I took it back. And we had a substitute teacher in history class one day, and had this red-headed kid that sat in front of me, and so I put this itching powder on his back, and about a third of the class knew what I was doing, and pretty soon he started scratching. The substitute teacher didn't know what was going on, and it was pretty disruptive that day when we all started laughing and carrying on. But
Could you put that on the clothes, and it would go through
the
clothes?
Skin. No, he just put it on the back skin above the collar.
And he didn't feel you put it on?
Mm-mm. No, it's just a powder you put it on, and pretty soon you reach back and feel it, and as soon as you start scratching, you're dead because it'll itch then.
No kidding.
And you'll just keep scratching. The more you scratch, the more we laugh. But
I really didn't know that there was such a thing as itching powder.
Yeah, it works.
Oh, no kidding.
But we cut class, and we did a lot of mischievous activities. I got acquainted with the principal's office. So.
Yeah, I saw it myself.
I guess I was in, probably not that unique, but I was in high school plays, a junior play and senior play. Did a lot of hunting and fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Always enjoyed going pheasant hunting and rabbit hunting and quail hunting, I guess. A little bit of fishing, not too much. So we had some recreation out on the farm too, or things we could do.
Yeah, sounds like a very complete childhood and young personhood, youthhood.
As I was finishing up high school, I don't know that I had a career picked out. I guess I remember times growing up, I said, you know, if I could just be a teacher, make $10,000 a year, man, I'd be on easy street, and that would be fun. And so I guess finally my folks persuaded me to go to Kansas State, which would have been the Ag College.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed a natural, having come through 4-H and FFA, to continue in agriculture, of course, being, you know, raised on a farm.
For
so
sure.
I started in agronomy and then switched over finally to ag education. And I was then, I guess, headed toward being a teacher at that stage of the game.
And your dad was pushing it that way.
Yeah, he was certainly pushing the agriculture side.
Yeah, but I remember something that you told me when we were outside, sitting on the lounge chairs, about the steadiness of the paycheck.
Oh, yeah, right. That was later on, of course.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that was after I actually come back from Southeast Asia and I went back into farming briefly with my dad. And that's when he said, well, even at that point, and we're jumping ahead several years, but at that point I'd contacted one of the guys that I went to college with, and he was the Department of Education, and he worked with all the WAG programs across the state. And so I'd called him up just to say, hey, what's the availability of teaching positions? Where are they at? What are you paying? And this sort of thing. And at that time he said, well, there's about four high school WAG teachers, teacher vacancies, and that if I wanted to go back into teaching, he would give me a conditional certification, and I could go back into teaching, and I'd have to pick up 9 hours, credit hours, to go ahead and, you know, get my license renewed.
Yeah.
And at that time, I asked him how much he was paying, and I think there's all the way up to $15,000 in 1975, so they still wasn't the big salaries yet.
No, not hardly.
And I said, well, I could probably starve on the farm as easy as going back into teaching. It didn't seem like there's much difference in the amount of money I was going to make. So about a month later, he called back and said, well, they've got a position with the Department of Ag. Would you be interested in applying for that? And I said, well, that sounds a little bit similar, at least, to some of the quasi-government type work I've been doing. So he said, well, why don't you go down and apply? They've got a job with the state meat inspection program, and they're looking for an administrator, assistant administrator. And so, as it turns out, I did apply and eventually was selected in that position.
Oh.
So that's how I kind of went from, if you may, from leaving Southeast Asia, coming home, farming for the summer, and then heading off for state work and not staying on the farm. I probably could have stayed on the farm, but and that's where the conversation came up. Dad said, well, you know, if you're interested in going back to work for government, you'll probably have a steady paycheck. You'll probably have more free time as far as being able to do things, and you'll have paid holidays. And farming is, the margin probably is not as great as it once was. You'll handle probably a lot of money, but on the other hand, you can lose it just as easy. And you may end up just enjoying working for the government better than staying out here on the farm. And so with that, I left the farm again the second time and headed back then for state government work.
Okay. See, I confused the timing of that story. I thought that might have been college age when you were trying to map out your future. Seems like that might have been a key time for a conversation like that to come up.
Well, if you jump back to the post-high school there, as I was going to K-State, probably about my sophomore, junior year, there was a IFE program. I don't know if you're familiar with it, International Farm Youth Exchange. That's really a six-month program in which you go over and live with farm families.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was in Europe. And I know I had several friends, and there's some correspondence in there in one of those albums that I had applied for an IFE program. And even there, I'm jumping ahead of really my interest in overseas, because I had a high school teacher that said, well, you ought to have a pen pal. And I ended up about three pen pals. I had a Japanese pen pal, a European pen pal, a German pen pal, and then I had one back in Pennsylvania. And so getting those letters, I suppose, was probably the earliest indication or the earliest time my interest in overseas work would have been tweaked a little bit. Like, well, that's kind of interesting what they do in Japan. That's kind of interesting what she's doing over there in Germany. And so I guess probably if I really went back to where I first was aware of, you know, overseas work or other countries would have probably been back in the pen pal days. And then to follow that up then with an interest of this International Farm Youth Exchange. And as it turns out, in that particular time frame, there's a lot of good college candidates for overseas, and a lot of them had varied experiences and probably was a little bit more mature than what I was even then. So I didn't get selected for that, but I guess I was still interested in going overseas. And then it was probably a year later, year and a half later, well, of course you had the Kennedys come on and says, you know, don't ask what you can do for your country. Yes, don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I'm still not saying it right.
Yeah, I
ask
get
not
it backwards.
What your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was also, I guess, interesting because I was doing my student teaching when the Kennedys were, you know, Kennedy was assassinated in Texas. So I went to school one morning and that occurred. And it was right, like I say, during my senior year in college. And so you tie the two together as far as my interest in IFE and the pen pals and then that deal with Kennedy. And so I went back and I had applied for Peace Corps.
You did?
As well as International Voluntary Services.
Uh-huh.
Well, Peace Corps came back and said, would you be interested in going to India on a poultry project?
Yep.
Well, I had heard through Larry Lawrence, who was an IBS Vietnamer and also a fraternity brother and graduate of Kansas State, that he said, well, I say it's from him, but anyway, probably from him, that, well, India had the highest number of dropouts for Peace Corps and the fewest number of returning volunteers as far as re-ups or
going back for extension. Okay.
And so it was a tough country for Peace Corps. I wasn't in love with poultry to start with. And we had enough Indian students, and I guess I knew that they didn't eat beef, and coming from Kansas up here, if they didn't eat beef, I didn't want to go there anymore. So I had, a cultural conflict.
Yeah.
So it made it easy for me to turn down Peace Corps, and in the meantime, then IBS came back, and I think it was Clifford Doak that was back there at that time, and they wrote and they said, well, we're looking for somebody fairly soon to go to Luang Prabang to the teacher training college up there. A guy by the name of Hank Holmes is finishing up in September, and we'd like to have somebody there before the end of the school year, or before the start of the school year.
Well, how did they find you?
I'd applied from Larry Lawrence.
Oh, because of Larry's influence.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right.
All right. So
I'd already contacted IBS and said, I'm a BOAG teacher, I'm doing my student teaching, I'm interested in going overseas, and
okay.
It just kind of fit the notch then in Luang Prabang.
Okay, so it's because Larry did more than talk you out of the Peace Corps India. He talked you into applying for IBS because it was through him you heard of that.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have heard of IBS otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, your religion wasn't like one of the peace churches where you might have been a CO and we're looking for alternate service. Okay. Yeah.
No, I was coming out of college at that time, and I could have went into teaching, I could have went back to the farm, or I could have went, in this case, IBS, and all three would have been, if you may, draft deferrable.
Mm-hmm.
So.
At least at that
unless,
point in time.
And at that point in time, I was not certainly a conscientious objector. I wasn't, but I guess I'd looked into Air Force.
Uh-huh.
And I told you about the airplanes.
Yeah,
I was interested in flying. And I'd even applied at one point in time to be a jet mechanic. And my folks said, well, you're going to spend a lot of money and you're going to go to jet mechanic school and they're not really going to promise you anything. And so they kind of talked me out of that. But anyway, if they would have promised me, if I thought that I could have been a jet pilot, I would have went into the Air Force.
You would have gone, huh?
But I heard other people say, oh, yeah, they'll bait you in and say, yeah, you'd be a pilot and then tomorrow you'd be greasing the wheels. So I said, well, I want to travel and I wasn't socially attached to anybody to the degree that I didn't feel that I could up and leave, and I hadn't signed any teaching contracts, and I didn't owe any money anywhere to speak of, or my folks sure had helped me through college. But I figured if I was going to travel, and I still had the desire to travel, then that was the perfect time.
Yeah.
And even though, sure, there was already newspaper accounts about the war in Laos and bombing up along the trail and some different military activities here and there. And, of course, my parents were concerned. And I said, oh, I've talked to them. It's not that bad. It's safe. And so I assured them that it wasn't the end of the world and I might come back.
And you had Larry's word.
I guess I had Larry's word.
Fooled by the fraternity brother again.
He'd come out of Vietnam, and obviously he'd survived Vietnam, and thought he had a great experience. So.
Yeah. So he must have been an older member in the fraternity. He must have been like a senior when you were legend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and then
that would have put him out
back.
Probably in about 19. He would have been in Vietnam, I'm guessing, probably 60, 62, somewhere in that time.
I could probably look it up. I've got some statistics on when people were where.
Yeah.
But he said it was okay.
Sure.
So it must be. He's there. He's alive. So.
So anyway, I had to finish. I had 3 hours or 6 hours. I forget what it was. I had a couple classes. I had to finish up for summer school, and so I stayed up at university and played softball and went to class and finished up in August, and I was almost reluctant to go because the team I was playing for was playing in the state championship for men's fast pitch softball. And they went ahead and won the state tournament. I always felt bad that I left before that was over, because that was always one of the loves of my life, was play softball.
Mm.
But anyway, we went back to Washington, D.C., and it was there's two of us, Dr. Jerry Porter and myself, and we flew back there, and they gave us some, I guess I got back a day early.
Uh-huh.
So I went through a modified or accelerated orientation one day, and then went sightseeing that afternoon, and the next morning they said, we'll come back in, and when I got ready to go back in, they said, well, we're going to cover the same thing with Dr. Porter today, why don't you go do some sightseeing? So I went and saw some more of Washington, D.C., and went home and packed my bags and got ready to head for Laos.
That was Jeremy?
Larry. Yeah. Larry Roberts.
No, Porter?
Oh, Dr. Jerry Porter, yeah.
Jermaine, right?
I suppose that's what he was about.
Jermaine. They have him here as 71 through 75. That was to Laos. Was he going to Laos or Vietnam? Well, there's no Porter here from Vietnam, so they must have gotten the years wrong here. Well, no, because we know when you were, when you went. Mm-hmm. And I looked up Larry. He was, he was 61, 63. So.
Yeah, that's about. That'd be about right then, because he would have come back in 63, and I graduated summer 64. So that'd be
just about right for.
He would have.
For you to have
it. And says, hey, looky here, just got back, and I would have been in the, starting in probably the fall semester.
Memory works out just perfect.
Someday
you'll
be lucky.
Yeah. Anyway, so you had this quickie sort of orientation. Yeah.
So a quick orientation, went back home and packed my bags. And it was interesting in a sense of not going in Washington, being part of a big group and going over in a group, because when I left, I was strictly solo out of Wichita, Kansas, and jump on a plane, and you say, well, I'm going over someplace I've never been, and I hope I get there.
Yeah.
You had a ticket, and you was off into the wild blue yonder, and I remember, flying to Tokyo, and it's kind of a funny experience there, because I arrived in Tokyo, and it was about 4 o'clock, and I thought it was 4 in the afternoon rather than 4 in the morning. I went up to the desk to check in. I said, well, is my room ready? And they said, no, it'll be a couple hours. And I said, a couple hours? It's already 4 o'clock. Thinking it was afternoon. And so finally about 6 o'clock, I got a room, went up, just about got to sleep, and I heard all the noise and went and looked, and it was the morning traffic. Everybody's going to work. So I'd already failed to take it, I was not cognizant of the time change, of the date change, and here I was going to bed as everybody's getting up. So then I quickly ran down and signed up for all the touristy tours of Japan, Japan by day, Japan by night, Tokyo by day, and see the geisha girls and whatever else. So I figured I was going to take advantage of what hours I had left there, and then flew to Hong Kong. And Hong Kong was, it was basically as a, as I'd seen and read a little bit about Hong Kong, and it was interesting. But my interest was heightened the next morning, because when I went out to the airport there at Kai Tak, I can't think of the name of the airport now, but anyway, on the way out there, well, here's all these newspaper people and correspondents, and they was all fighting to get on that flight, and I couldn't figure out what in the heck was going on.
And this would have been in when?
August of 64.
Okay.
And that coincided with some major political activity in Vietnam, and I want to say it was either a coup d'etat or attempted coup, but all the correspondents were running back out of Hong Kong to get in to cover the news. So as it turns out, I sat beside a Wall Street correspondent, and we flew over the 7th Fleet, and everybody was looking out one side of the plane, wondering if it didn't tip over. But anyway, looking at the 7th Fleet on maneuvers, and I don't know the relationship on that, when the so-called, was that the Tonkin incident? Not sure the chronological timing. But anyway, when I got into Saigon, there was a member of the embassy that, I don't know, he came on board the plane, or he warned us right at the beginning. He said, if you don't have business in Saigon, we just assume or prefer that the Americans go. And I thought, well, I'll go on. I don't have to stay here.
But, yeah, I'm going to Laos.
One of the IVESers,
it's peaceful there.
Yeah, one of the IVESers there, and he said, oh, don't worry, come on. And we jumped in the back of the Jeep, and we went through, and here's the barbed wire and the Vietnamese soldiers and weapons loaded. And I said, what have I got myself into here? But they kept trying to reassure me that everything was fine, so I went to IVS Hostel and went out to eat some Vietnamese food that night, visited with some of the IVSers in Vietnam, and then the next day, we got on what they referred to as the proverbial milk run, and that was an old C-47 loaded with pigs and chickens and opium runners and drug runners, but gold smugglers and whatever else, and take off for...
Was that Air America or something?
No, it was Air Saigon, probably.
Oh, really? Okay, it was commercial.
It was a commercial airplane, and it's flying the old C-46s.
Because
47s.
Yeah. Because IVS could use military flights and things like that.
Yeah, this is commercial at that time.
Oh.
Because I was still en route to the duty station. I wasn't yet on there. In-country.
So maybe because you weren't officially in the roster yet.
So anyway, I arrived at the airport, and the chief of party there was Bernie Wilder. So
mm-hmm.
He had been my first boss over there.
Yeah.
Like I say, today he continues to be a very close friend and colleague, I guess. But anyway, I met Bernie there, and I don't know whether Pat Bosler was already an associate chief of party, but I think he was at the airport to meet me, and so we spent a day or two again of a brief orientation there in Vientiane, and of course being a big party of one.
Very big group.
They didn't have a whole lot of activities either scheduled or planned, and so they went ahead and rather than start any Lao classes, they went ahead and sent me right on up to Luang Prabang because they wanted me to overlap with the guy's name we was talking about, Hank Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to overlap with him before he left, and he was due out in about 2 weeks, so they wanted me to
at least meet the man.
2 weeks and
get
and
some
let him orient, introduce me to the school and
sure,
and around town and get me situated.
If I can interrupt for a second here. Because I was looking up Wilder's name. Let me pause this. I turned this back on again. Sorry to interrupt you, but I did want to say that about Johnson or Walter. And, you know, let you know that. Now, do you remember where you were? Because I'm not sure.
Well, we had just arrived in Vientiane.
Okay,
and we had a short orientation.
Yeah.
And I was off to Luang Prabang to overlap with Hank Holmes.
Right.
And so the first 2 weeks there, of course, it was kind of a whirlwind. It's the first adjustment to living changes, food changes, tropics.
Yeah.
The whole nine yards. And so he was certainly a very, I'd say, a very competent and dynamic individual. Of course, one of his claim to fame was the Laotian songbook. He had spent his 2 years in Luang Prabang and knew his certainly way around. And he had also, I think, played tennis with the Crown Prince and knew the nobility, if you may, of Luang Prabang and was very well known in the whole country because the king had signed off maybe king and queen, probably king, but signed off and kind of a co-sponsory songbook and the cultural.
Really?
Because
you showed me the book, but I didn't see that.
Yeah. So So anyway, I was obviously following in some pretty big footsteps, and of course, I think he was probably a little bit more linguistically inclined than what I was. Certainly, he was pretty fluent in the Laotian language, and I wasn't. Of course, I didn't have any Lao training at that point in time, and all they did, they sent me an instructor, but they said, you can only have him 2 weeks because the main group is coming.
Oh, no.
So you get him for 2 weeks, and that's it.
And the 2 weeks was when you were also being shown around.
Right.
So that doesn't really do very well.
And school was about ready to start. And
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So I don't know whether I got off on exactly what I call a running start or not. It was kind of challenging. And then, too, I think all of us were probably fairly aware of the first 6 months and the adjustment and that kind of a cultural shock.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make it for 6 months, you probably got it made. So
yeah. Well, what, you know, in that culture shock, what were some of the things that you found not most shocking, but in terms of the biggest impressions that were made of you as this young kid from the central part of the country and then wind up in Laos?
Well, I would probably go back and at least start by, let's say, setting the stage of what was going on in Luang Prabang. And I don't remember now, Luang Prabang is probably 10,000 people. It's a fairly good sized city. And of course, like I say, it was the home of the royal palace and the king of Laos. And,
uh-huh.
And so there was a lot of ceremonies and, you know, the learning of the Laotian culture, which we hadn't really, since I said I just, you know, very briefly immersed it. So really hadn't went through any sort of training as what you do and don't do.
Yeah.
Just there.
Yeah.
Bang. there was a, I probably learned some of the culture from the missionaries. They had two missionary families there. One was Gustafson.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the Ruoffs. But anyway, the Ruoffs was an old missionary family. They'd been in Laos forever and written a Laotian language book that the Americans were basically using at that time.
Uh-huh.
But then there was a guy named Wayne Hammer, of course, he was ex-IVS. There was a Vandrell family, was up there, they was basically aid education. And there was John McLean, who was a real dynamic and just a fantastic USIS individual there. And he spoke three or four languages and did pretty well even in tribal languages.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I can't say enough good about him because he was just the person, man about town, as far as doing things and knowing everybody. And I mean, he was super active.
Yeah.
And then there was about that time, Stacy Lloyd came in. Of course, he was a fairly well-educated and I think came from a family with means from back east. And he was later USIS there. And then we had some Thai and Thai and Filipinos there, Filipino radio operators. And that was kind of the American community. There was one IVS girl, and then they was about 30 miles outside of town at Vong Vieng, there was four IVSers. There was a couple, the Worleys, and then Wingard and Joe Flipsy. So anyway, that was kind of the sitting, but I was the only person out at this teacher training college is located about a mile outside of town. And that particular teacher training college, I suppose, had about 60 students, and it started off kind of like a one-year teacher training college, and then they added the second year, and I think it eventually became a four-year teacher training college. But when I was there, it was just 2 years.
So it was only 2 years old?
Well, no, it wasn't much older than that. It had to be at least that much, because Hank was out there working on it. I don't remember when the actual construction of it started, but they didn't build any more on it after I got there anyway, but they did add the second year.
Uh-huh.
And so...
So maybe his first year was spent in the building of it.
Could have been. But they basically, then if you went to that teacher training college, let's see how that goes. If you went to the... It was phasing in the second year, but if you went to one, you went out and taught grades 1, 2, and 3. And then if you finished the extra year, then you'd go out and teach grades 4, 5, and 6.
Hmm.
And then later, of course, you know, you had to have more years to be qualified to go out and do the teaching. So you had some fairly young people there that didn't get a whole lot of training before they went back to the jungle, so to speak, to teach. Of course, it was I was the only American out there. They did have a, of course, a French teacher that taught some French, and then the rest of the classes were all Laotian.
Mm-hmm.
A Chow Chantabadi was the head of the school then. Of course, the Chow meant he was of the royal family. And I don't know, I didn't necessarily hit it off the greatest with him. I guess I didn't have that much respect for the royal family just at that point in time. And I thought a lot of them were kind of, I don't know, they got their wealth and their prestige with bloodlines, not necessarily through hard work and education. And the second year then, another young director came on board, and he was from France, and he was of the Ponce Abai family, which is a Poxé family. And of course, he is young and just out of France, and we just really clicked, and that was probably when my interest in IVS took off, because if it would have been the first 6 months and under the previous administration, I don't know, I probably had my down days about that 6 month, and we were talking about culture shock. Yeah, I was out in this little, had a Lao house on the edge of town, and it was a little one-bedroom mosquito net over the bed, and had a couple pieces of furniture, and I was lucky enough to have a kerosene refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And you had rainwater in the barrels, and you could pump it out of the cistern and up into a barrel, and it was kind of Laotian in the fact that I had this wooden handle on a grape juice can, about a 6 ounce can, and so you went out there with your Laotian sarong on, and you dipped the water out of the 55-gallon barrel, and I think I got it down one time I could actually take a bath on a cold morning with 6 cans of water.
Really? That's good.
It was cold, you bathe fast. It wasn't even that thing of warm water.
I got to tell you a story of my own taking of a bath for the first time, and I won't waste the tape. I'll just pause this, but I think you'll like this.
Well, at least it was an improvement over the cold.
Yeah, I turned this back on again. Yeah, no, if you heat up some water, yeah.
And then we used that later when we went up to Montana, and we went up to visit some friends, and they lived up on the Gallatin River, and she didn't have any plumbing in an outdoor toilet. So we had to go out in the river and take a bath, and I said, it's too cold. And I said, I'll show you what I learned in Laos. So we heated up the water on the stove, the wood stove, ran out the river, and then blended the river water and
mm-hmm.
take a warm bath.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, at least do somewhat well.
So we learned how to adapt a little bit there.
Yeah.
But anyway, we was leading into a little bit some of the cultural things you ran into, of course, in the royal palace, of course, and if you're around royalty, but of course you could never have your head higher than the king's head, so you always had to duck your head, and of course you weren't supposed to point the bottom of your feet at anybody, that wasn't polite, you weren't supposed to touch anybody on the
Whoops.
Head, I didn't necessarily take pride in raising your voice, so you were supposed to talk in a low, steady tone, in control.
Mm-hmm.
But a combination of things, I guess, occurred. Certainly, I did spend some time with the missionary family. They had me over about once every 2 or 3 weeks for supper, and they had a couple kids that was going to Da Nang or Da Lat to the missionary school over there. And so they kind of took me under their wing, and at the same time, I got acquainted with a French couple. And they were teaching at the Lycée in Luang Prabang, and a man and his wife, and they were, of course, older than I was, but not that old. And so they started inviting me to go over and to a little Vietnamese cafe and have lunch, and all the French teachers kind of gathered there. So I started going there for lunch, and I'd go to a Chinese restaurant at night. And the Chinese restaurant, I eat there often enough that I finally ordered some ketchup. Needed some good Heinz ketchup, so I ordered some ketchup from the commissary and stuck it in the Chinese refrigerator, and so I'd have to bring it out. And we had a deer steak or something. I'd say, bring my Nam Mak Lin, which would be the closest translation for ketchup I'd come up with, and they'd bring the ketchup out, and I'd do the deal on French fries and steak, and then go put my American ketchup back in the Chinese refrigerator. But
the French couple was they were also become very good friends and probably remained just recently. I kind of lost contact with them temporarily, but they were some of my closest friends for years.
Mm-hmm.
And they would invite me over to French activities, and of course they had a French military outpost there. So they had French military teaching Laotian soldiers how to fight, use weapons, one thing or another, and of course you'd have your French holidays in, and the Bastille Day, and, and the other various holidays, and so I'd always get invited in to go to all the French activities.
Did you know French?
I faked it. I knew just enough to get in trouble. I'd shake my head and smile and act like I understood a hell of a lot more than I ever did.
Yeah, yeah.
But they, of course, taught English. And he had been a translator for the military way back when, and so they spoke fluent English. And so I didn't have to necessarily know French. They taught me a few words. And then, of course, when I went with some of their friends that didn't speak any English, by then I didn't, you know, I get by with a little bit of French, but as far as being able to converse in French, I never did get that good. But anyway, that kind of made life bearable then, and kind of got over the hump of the, you know, being out there in a different environment, and language I still didn't understand at that point in time yet. Still didn't have that much formal Lao or whatever. I kind of picked up on my own then. And then as I started getting more acquainted with the teachers and the students, and I started, of course, Thanksgiving and Christmas was kind of lonely, you know, not being not really celebrated over there to the extent we do here, and being away from home for the first Christmas and home for the first Thanksgiving, but those were kind of downers. But, you know, as your interest, I guess, expands, and as you get more and more involved in what's going on in the community, playing some tennis on Sundays, and I was going to, sometimes students would say, come on out, we're going to do such and such, and we'd go to the river, or French would say, you know, let's go out and do this, or just as you got involved, and then I had some students who wanted to learn English, that they worked over at the Chao Quain's office, which would be like the district governor's office. So there was about five, actually, women that worked in the office, all clerical types. And then I had a couple of military guys, and they'd come to the house every night, and we'd have English classes. And then I was doing some coaching at the school, and working on the garden projects, and working with the pigs we had. And then just general, if you may, any sort of assistance that came up through AID as far as textbooks, chalk, lawnmower. I mean, one time we even had a lawnmower out there.
A lawnmower?
Paint. Yeah, paint for the dorms, or paint for the school buildings. Working with USIS and working with the Asia Foundation. By then, the more things that you got involved in, the more it started being, let's say, natural, and the less you worried about being homesick. And, it just started looking forward to whatever was going on, whatever you was going to accomplish. Certainly, I can't say that I ever wrote a songbook and got it published, but on the other hand, it was a wealth of experiences of just meeting people and working with multi-cultural, if you may, activities. But like, say, the French, there was British doctors, British volunteers up there at that time that worked over at the hospital, and so they had a couple of real good British doctors and volunteers I got acquainted with, and I later went and visited them in England, and just those type of activities, just other opportunities unfolded, and
so
I don't know, it just started becoming an interesting assignment, and that's probably then what went ahead then and got me interested in going ahead and extending my tour. At the 6 month level, I would say, no, I'm going home 2 years, and if I make it, then that'll be it. At the 18-month, two-year, why it was, oh my God, the 2 years up already, now we're ready.
Yeah, that's a good sign, isn't it? Yeah, it seems to me, too, like the community of folks that you established there were the substitute for having a bunch of IBS friends from a training group.
So, Betty Morgan was the IBS girls in there, and certainly she was working in a little bit of hospital and food feeding programs and child
mm-hmm.
raising programs and the RD type of experience, you know, and certainly four down at the living room and RD volunteer. But I didn't see a whole lot of them. They'd come in a little bit, but and I didn't go out to Zingman that often either to see them. They were working on, you know, dispensaries and well rings and irrigation canals and
mm-hmm.
all the rural development type activities. So anyway, the 2 years finally snuck up on me there toward the end, and of course I'd moved about twice as far as residences. I'd moved into the aid compound for a little bit and then out to a house, and I had a real neat house. And you saw the neighborhood kids on the front porch that would come by. And, one point of interest, I guess, it was right across from an opium den, so I could always smell the opium when I walked home. They'd be over there smoking the opium, and it was really about even probably only 50 yards from the lease and another 100 yards from the hotel, and I knew the people over the hotel, and I'd, of course, you know, become the local tourist guide, so if somebody come up from Bin Chin or any VIPs by, I usually got designated to take them up to the caves or take them out to the waterfalls or take them out and show them the school, so I was kind of a tour guide, too.
Yeah, the caves are interesting. The caves we're talking about, are the 30 kilometers, was it?
It was about 30 kilometers north of Luang Prabang up the Mekong, and it was
yeah.
at the, like I said, Paku, which is right at the mouth of the Hu River.
Yeah. And then holding Buddhist relics.
Buddhist relics, yeah.
So you were the tour guide up there.
During Lao New Year, of course, they always had a big
same as ten.
Mass movement. Everybody, they chartered all the boats, and everybody went up there, and they had a big festival up there, and they went up and painted the relics or cleaned up around and everything else. It was quite a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But, so there's a combination of things there. One, certainly starting to learn a little language, getting acquainted with the community, getting involved in the community, developing some friends, having a change in the director, and things just got better.
What was the director change?
Well, the director of the school, the Chow Chanamadi, to the new young guy back in France, that was... Well, he's a little bit more pro-Western, if you may. He was real dynamic and young, and we just clicked together, really.
Yeah.
Where the other guy was really the old, well, I got my position because I am who I am.
Yeah, because I'm royal blood, and
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So did you ever really get to know any of the loyal family? It sounds like you're pretty prejudiced against them. And
oh, yeah, I... being a small American community there, but I certainly was always invited to do all of the activities. So if we had the governor's office had a reception or something, we was invited. They had something at the palace, we was invited. So we got to go to the both years I was there to the Lao New Year's big
mm-hmm.
grand festival there. And of course, they'd always invite the ambassador and the VIPs from aid up. And so as the local little community, we always got to go over and. And then
that's not really getting to know any of the royalty, though.
No, not so much knowing them. I suppose there was a couple of them. The Crown Prince never did get to know him very well. He did invite me over one time to his house at a New Year's party and have a drink with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was all right. Chow Ge, who was the middle prince, he took all the students up to the garden and probably had a little bit more knowledge of him, but they were still distant, if you may. I was just an American there, and he was
in
the royal blood. They did let me invite me to the wedding, though, for the Crown Prince, and I got to take pictures of that, and,
uh-huh.
and that was kind of an honor. And then there was one lady that, I think she had worked for aid a little bit, and she was also royal blood, and she came up, and she had a good friend of hers that was also a very attractive Latin lady that got acquainted with. And then there was a couple of the other Laotian women that were fairly attractive of royal blood that were younger than in Europe and educated. And so I got to know them. And so they would be the closest, I suppose, to the royal family as far as getting acquainted and being able to talk to them or go do some things. But...
But there's no friendships that were developed.
No, not any where I communicate with them. You know, just running palace, no.
No, yeah.
No, nothing quite of that. Maybe.
No, not running over to the palace to borrow a cup of sugar for the recipe or things like that. That I wouldn't have expected, but, you know, if you had worked with any of the princes on any projects or things like that.
Never did. Certainly didn't follow the footsteps of Hank Holmes in that case. He was unique in that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I just, there was just something that occurred to me. What did you coach?
Basketball.
Oh.
They
enjoyed the game?
Training college. And of course, they had a lot of Chinese there. They had a Chinese school. Of course, Chinese were good basketball players. And they had a court in town. And at least they, of course, played some basketball. And so
okay.
I just did some coaching of the teacher training students.
And then, mostly, though, you, maybe I didn't catch it all, but seemed like a lot of your job was getting resources for them.
Sure. I didn't have an actual teaching assignment. All the classes were
right.
In Ocean, and they didn't have an English section like they did down below. So
uh-huh.
It was more of a kind of a liaison, help them with the school, help them with supplies, help them with gardening, help them with basketball. If you want to teach an English class, that's fine. If there's teachers there, it's interesting. So I taught some of the teachers there, and then I'll say the secretaries in town, Chuck Wayne's office.
Right.
And some of the military that wanted the English classes, and so it was kind of a mixed bag of English classes. Yeah.
Probably fairly motivated people, though.
Reasonably so, yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't all necessarily high educated, but certainly interested in you know, whatever it would.
No, it sounds to me like people who wanted to learn English for some very practical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from a general who has to interact with American military to the secretaries who might have to do something too. Yeah, so that would probably went pretty well as a teaching experience, better than back home.
If you went
in high school,
if you even went and looked at some of the letters that the English class of the women, now I would say that probably 3 out of 4 of them were married and probably had a family, but they probably became as close of friends coming to English class every night, and they'd always want to have a Christmas party, and we'd get gifts, and it'd be kind of a gag gift, and they'd always want to say, well, let's bring some Lao food over, and they just, it's almost like family. So they probably became, as far as the Laotian family, as close as anybody in Luang Prabang, with the exception of the, I'd say that Ponce Abai was the second director, and then Powell, the assistant superintendent out there, he and his family was always very supportive. I mean, he was always wanting to make sure I was, you know, okay, and anything he could do to help. And during the first administration, he was probably my closest confidant and colleague out there at the school.
Is that the fellow who was working on the typewriter in one
no,
of your...
No, that was later on. That was an assistant rural Chow Quain
oh,
type
that's right. Yeah,
primary
okay.
education
oh, okay.
type.
I got
that was later on. In
you had cool words for him, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of them were excellent people to work with, but that would have been back...